Now, play of the week. We present Who Wrote Horseback Hall? By Michael Robson, with John Rye as Hector Monroe, the writer better known by his pen name, Saki. The time is November 1916. The place, the First World War battlefields in Flanders.
Yes.
Sorry to disturb you, sir, but he's still here.
Who is?
Well, that sergeant, sir.
Henderson. Which sergeant?
Well, he won't go away, sir.
Won't go away?
Who says he has to talk to you, sir?
Has he, though? Whose patient is he?
Major Donovan, sir.
Then tell this obstinate sergeant to pester Major Donovan. Don't waste any more of my time.
Sir, he said, do you remember when William came, sir?
What the devil are you both talking about, man? What's he being treated for?
Malaria, sir.
Then clearly he's still in the grip of a fever. So what's he doing out of bed and wandering around the hospital? Send him back to the ward sister and tell him I want no more of this nonsense.
What's that?
When William came. Just a moment, Henderson.
Sir.
What's the sergeant's name?
It's Monroe, sir.
Age?
46, sir.
Then he's a regular.
No, sir, he's a volunteer.
Is he an educated man?
Well, sir, Major Donovan found out that he speaks French, German and Russian, sir, and some Polish and Serbian.
Good God. And he's a sergeant?
Sir.
Look here, Henderson. Ask him what he thinks of Saki.
Wait, Paul, sir.
What he thinks of Saki. Hmm? Just that. Then report back to me.
Sir. Yeah. Sarge.
Why not? Come on.
Sir, he said, Saki is almost certainly the finest writer this century has produced.
He would, wouldn't he? Send him in, Henderson.
Well, send him in, sir.
Into this office, Henderson, now.
Sir! Come in, Sarge.
Thank you.
Hector, you clown. What kind of game is this you're playing?
It's good to see you, Bertie. I thought it must be you behind the green baize door.
This is incredible. Incredible. That'll be all, Henderson. Well, sit down, sit down.
Thank you.
You look terrible.
Oh. Well, the war's funny that way. It seldom improves a man's health.
This go of malaria... Did you pick it up at the front?
No, in Burma in 95.
Yes, Burma, of course.
It flares up, periodically. But I'm well enough now, and that's why I wanted to see you.
Hoping for a spot of convalescent leave, I'll have a word with Donovan.
Not leave, Bertie. I want to get back to the front.
Out of the question. You'd be a liability in the state you're in now.
There's plenty of chaps up there worse off than I am. Oh, please, discharge me.
Look, man, I'm a doctor. Soldiering's a secondary consideration. I can't possibly authorize a discharge when you collapse before you got within 20 miles of the front.
Ah. Well, thank you anyway for seeing me.
Where are you going?
Oh, back to my ward.
Not so hasty. We haven't met since heaven knows when.
Jealous. Late autumn of 13, hunting party. Maisie Quabal took a toss by full-blown spinney, and you had the pleasure of doing field repairs on her.
Maisie Quabal. I wonder what became of that one.
Oh, she went to New York, I understand, in search of a newer, richer husband.
Look, we must talk, and at length. What about tomorrow evening? Here. About 1800. Hmm? I'll square it with Matron and Donovan.
Oh, thank you. Then, just one request. I've been a dry ward for a month, and that's doing no good to my morale. Any chance of a bottle of Bordeaux? For the sake of my palate. Claret, 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 called the colonel. Ah, thank you. That was very good, Bertie. Mm. Ah, it is good.
I thought you'd approve. Cigarette?
I live with a pipe now.
I don't believe it.
Tea and tobacco. Keep those coming and we'll win this war.
And when it's over... Will Saki take up the pen again?
Oh, I'll keep on writing. I need to earn my way.
But my choice of subject will probably be rather different from what it once was. Or it could hardly be otherwise. The world I chose to inhabit has vanished, thank God.
Oh, you enjoyed it well enough at the time. So did I.
Didn't we all? Those of us who could afford it. The only cause for disquiet was the occasional scarcity of plovers, eh?
Well, you made a handsome living from describing it. Have you turned to a more popular mode since you've been soldiering? If so, will it please the lovers of sake? Are barrack room ballads in his line?
Ah. Kipling has something I've never possessed or wanted till the war. He understands how to use the language of a soldier to good effect, when all I knew was the conversation of the drawing room and the tennis courts, and the limited, if recondite, vocabulary of the hunt. Now, I'm probably stuck with it now, but I can employ it for different ends.
More wine.
Thank you.
Nevertheless, you did have the satisfaction of predicting a war with Germany when William came. A year before the shooting started.
Oh, everything I wrote gave me some satisfaction. I hit the ball, yes, but my area of aim was too limited. These last few weeks, I've been trying to extend it. It's the kind of thing I should have been writing 6 years ago. Detached and callous as always, but this time ringing the tocsin rather loudly.
I'd like to read it.
I can only extemporize it. And extemporization is not my forte.
Try.
You recall we last met at Janet's. It's there my story takes place, because it's the archetype of what 100,000 subalterns believe they're still fighting and dying for. And yes, those summer days did have their charm.
Morning, Aunt. Great heavens, it's the 3rd of August, 1910.
Why should that astonish you?
You're always forgetting how absent-minded you are. Unless one tells you the day, the month, and the year, you're quite liable to neglect all your social obligations.
What an extravagant claim, Hector.
Very well, then. Since that's your attitude, I shan't bother to remind you of the house party this weekend.
House party? I'm not attending a house party this weekend.
No, Aunt. You're giving one.
Oh, the boy's insane. What was that?
The call of a peacock on the lawn.
Why was he calling?
To assure you he's still in good voice.
Hector, unless you abandon this unfortunate flippancy, I may reconsider my decision to invite you to spend October with me.
The month is August, Aunt Eleanor.
How could I be expected to know that? Haven't I enough on my mind already?
So much on your mind that the foundations are beginning to crack.
Oh, thank heaven your poor mother isn't alive and standing by to hear you make mock of me in this fashion.
My poor mother is jogging along on 8,000 a year in Monte Carlo. It's my father who was called to his eternal rest during a scramble to the crush bar at Her Majesty's Theatre. After downing his champagne, he was heard to remark, "And plenty more where that came from, Maud. Dear father, an optimist to the end."
I do so wish you'd stick to the point, Hector.
Your house party.
Ah, yes, the house party. Would you fetch my diary, darling, and I shall prove you wrong.
Where is your diary?
Oh, don't ask me. Isn't it enough that I keep a diary without having the additional onus of remembering where it is?
Ah, nestling between Debrett and Fox's Book of Martyrs. An odd comment on country entertainment, Aunt Eleanor. Today is Friday, the 3rd of August.
Yes. Here it is, Friday, the 3rd of August. Marrow fat peas to vicar, send to library for latest Hall Caine. Marjoram, electoral reform. You see, there's no mention of a house party.
But a decisive mention of electoral reform.
Yes. What could possibly have prompted me to set down such an outrageous notion?
Could it be in some way connected with a member of your forthcoming house party?
Of course it could. Otherwise, why would it be there? One of my guests is to be Mr. Hugo Crefton.
And he's interested in electoral reform.
I sincerely hope he's determined to stamp it out.
Just shy them up there, would you, Paul?
Right here, sir.
That's the ticket. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Tuppence should do very well indeed, after 40 years, if properly invested.
Did you hear that? What insolence.
Insolence? It seemed to me to show a quite remarkable prudence. Were that porter to invest every tip he receives in a sound consolidated trust, he would, after the 40 years he mentioned, be able to buy himself as handsome a little yacht as you could wish to see at Angmering.
Why at Angmering?
Oh, I think he'd find cows rather ostentatious, don't you?
I chose this admittedly remote compartment in the hopes of being able to have it to myself. When I travel by train, I invariably read. One has all too little time for reading in the normal course of events.
Then my life must be full of abnormality, since I devote at least 3 hours a day to reading.
Are you a public librarian, sir?
A politician, ma'am.
In the upper chamber, of course.
The lower.
But I've always understood that the members of that unfortunate place are triumphantly illiterate.
The secret sin of Lady Harriet Debchance.
If you mean to introduce impropriety into the conversation at this early stage of the journey, I shall have no hesitation in pulling the communication cord.
I was merely reading the title of the book to which you're trying to address yourself.
I say,
do you happen to know if this train stops at Nettleship on Fridays?
My knowledge of the timetable does not rest on coincidence. I made it my footman's business to ascertain the stops well before I embarked on this journey.
And what did he discover, that it does or does not stop at Nettleship?
Sir, it does.
Then I'm greatly obliged to your footman.
Well, that person would not be impressed with your gratitude. Like all members of what may best be described as the practical class, he nourishes a healthy contempt for all politicians and is perfectly willing to leave the ordering of his life to his employer.
May I ask you how much you pay your footman?
You may ask, but why should I furnish you with a reply? Is your own footman unsatisfactory?
Oh, I abolished the position of footman the moment I inherited the household.
Abolished? Then what became of the unhappy incumbent of their position? Was he thrown, broken-hearted, into the street to seek his fortune as a small tradesman in West Acton?
I gave him passage money and enough capital to set up as a sheep farmer in New Zealand. That was 20 years ago. He prospered and now owns 10,000 acres of the finest grazing land in the Southern Island.
This is monstrous. If the rest of us followed your reckless example, there wouldn't be a footman to be found in the whole of Mayfair.
But you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs.
Do I understand you to mean that you've made inroads into the kitchen staff also? The most hopeful inference that may be drawn from that remark is that you live alone, never entertain, and take all your meals at your club.
Well, I foresee a time, not too far ahead, when a social convulsion of such magnitude will occur that after it, there will be virtually no domestic labor force on which the inhabitants of Mayfair may draw. You and your kind will find it necessary to make your own beds, sweep your own floors, light your own fires, prepare your own meals, wash your own plates, answer your own doors, collect your own letters from the hall, and pour the drinks for your guests yourselves.
Let me make quite sure I understand you. In the tragic event that you become this country's next Prime Minister, do you intend to introduce legislation that will summarily transport the entire domestic staff of Great Britain to the Antipodes, there to raise mutton and card wool?
Mrs. Winifred Hope, milady.
Oh, Winifred, darling, how delightful to see you again.
Spare me these social blandishments, Eleanor, and tell me what possessed you to invite as a guest to your house party an anarchist of the deepest dye.
Are you perhaps rehearsing for yet another play with your local amateur?
My words spring directly from an overcharged breath. I have had the misfortune to be closeted from St. Pancras to Nettleship with the most dangerous man in England.
To which gentleman do you refer?
I speak of one Mr. Hugo Crefton, M.P.
Mr. Crefton, as retiring and mild a Tory as ever wore blue at the hustings.
Eleanor, your skills in amnesia provoke the admiration of society from London to the Trossachs. But on this occasion, you have overstepped the mark almost deliriously. Crefton is a traitor, a viper in the nest,
a tartar in the woodpile, and a stoat in the main draft.
Your shower of metaphors, many of them so originally conceived, have alarmed me without enlightening me. What is the matter, Winnie?
Mr. Hugo Crefton, my lady.
Too late, the monster advances. Mm.
Did I hear you correctly, Strubble?
Should I try again, m'lady, and in a higher key?
Thank you, no, Strubble. That will be all for the time being.
Lady Eleanor, good afternoon. And how charming of you to invite me here on what can only have been the most fleeting of acquaintanceships, since I don't recall ever having had the pleasure of meeting you before today.
Good afternoon, sir. May I inquire, are you Mr. Hugo Crefton or another man of the same name?
Now we come to it.
Well, my surname was always Crefton, and I've been Hugo ever since my godparents stood with me at the font. Other men, quite probably, are also known as Hugo Crefton, but I can claim no responsibility for them. They have their lives and I mine.
And to what is that life of yours dedicated, Mr. Crefton?
Why, to universal franchise, home rule for Ireland, free trade, the better education of the underprivileged, and, of course, electoral reform.
What did I say? The serpent in the woolsack.
Tell me, Mr. Crefton, do you approve of hunting?
Hunting for what? For the answer to the social dilemmas of our age?
That will suffice. Clearly, I was thinking of another gentleman with a similar name.
Similar? Oh, now then, let's rack the brains a moment.
Oh, not in public, I beg you.
Well, there is a Tory of absolutely no significance in the House at present. Never opens his mouth, except to order a drink at question time. Lives in fear of the whips, of his constituents, of his mother, and of ever being challenged to declare his opinions on the floor.
Now we come to the nub of the matter. This charming and diffident gentleman, what would he be called?
Well, as I recollect, Mr. Drago Sefton.
Oh, how I warned you, Eleanor. And now my admonitions have proved well-founded. Hoist with your own petard.
Don't you think, Mr. Honiton, that Jallet's must be one of the most enchanting places in the world in which to spend a lazy summer weekend?
I should be inclined to agree, Miss Carew, were it not for that utterly distasteful piece of statuary that we observe in background left.
Beyond the rose archway, you mean?
And rearing obtrusively beneath the magnolias, an affront to art and man.
I find it insipid, to be sure, but distasteful, hardly.
Have I ever been heard to pronounce on the merits or deficiencies of those colleagues of yours who eke out some kind of competence on the popular stage?
Why, no, I don't believe I have. But then we've only known one another for 5 minutes, haven't we?
5 minutes are enough for a lifetime of candor, Miss Carew. And my reputation as a senior member of the Royal Academy entitles me to pronounce with unquenchable conviction that that statue of Venus arising from the foam should never, ever have been exposed to the eyes of man.
You're very positive, aren't you?
In this matter, assertive to the point of violence.
Have you made your views known to Lady Eleanor?
I haven't had an opportunity, have I? But I shall find one, you may be sure, before or during dinner this evening.
Oh, dear.
Why, oh, dear, pray?
Because I happen to know that the statue to which you've taken such a bitter dislike is a particular favorite of her ladyship's.
Then I shall oblige her to review her artistic prejudices. I have seen objects of more worth defiling the back gardens of terraced houses in Bethnal Green.
How extensively travelled you are, Mr. Honiton.
Hello there.
Hector! We haven't met since the opening night of Fingal's Follies at the Gaiety.
Munro. We haven't met since my last exhibition in the Bruton Street Galleries, when you described my paintings as being overpriced to the point of modesty.
Bobo enchanted. Honiton,
yourself. Had I realized you were going to be here, I should have had second thoughts about accepting your aunt's invitation.
And have them now, by all means. The last train doesn't leave until 9:30. Plenty of time for your man to pack.
Your years abroad have scarcely improved your manner.
Just sharpening my nails. I enjoy pinking social lions.
Hector, when you've quite finished bickering with Mr. Honiton, you might spare a thought for me.
If I did, it would be so confoundedly one-sided.
Oh, if you persist in teasing every girl you know as abominably as you tease me, can one wonder that you're still an unkempt bachelor?
Bobo, I own with pride to being a bachelor. All single men should, but unkempt. Did ever a chap spend more time considering his wardrobe than I?
Well, that may be true, but do you consider it to any purpose?
I do believe that despite your better nature, you stumbled across a witticism.
We mustn't take any notice of him, Mr. Honiton. He's just a ridiculous gadfly stinging the fortunate through envy or for want of something more constructive to do.
I should be inclined to admire that remark if I hadn't heard it from Mrs. Hope above a dozen times. However, your memory does you credit, if not your natural instinct for plagiarism.
I don't know when I've heard such an utterable claptrap in all me born days.
But months of nonsense in prenatal time.
In the very near future, I hope you will provoke someone to the extent that they'll shoot you down like a dog.
I think we have the makings of an inspiring weekend. Shall we go to TV?
Have you seen the guest list, Vanessa?
Not as yet.
You should. It simply confirms Lady Eleanor's unerring lack of discernment in these matters.
Eh, surely she hasn't invited the Bishop of Bodmin again. I remember how appalled you were by his choice of adverbs.
Much, much worse than Bodmin awaits us. Not only is her nephew, that scamp Munro, here to badger us, but also that loose-mouthed socialist Crefton. Crefton. And I shall be expected to play him at bridge and billiards when she knows I can't stand the sight of the fella.
Mr. Crefton, oh, I heard all about that from Winifred Hope while you were arguing with Strabble. It appears that poor Eleanor's done it again. She intended to invite a Tory MP called Drago Sefton. But to whom should the invitation go but to Hugo Crefton?
I suppose it's about par for Eleanor's course. But I warn you, if he starts airing his frightful revolutionary theories anywhere near me, I shall jump on him pretty sharply.
I'm not the disapprover you are, Randall. I find him uncommonly handsome. And his gift for entertaining invective is certain to mark him out for some high office of state. We're all inhabitants of Horseback Hall, darling, but at least Mr. Crefton knows us to be galloping neck and crop for a last disastrous fence. While the sun still shines on our selfishness, be prepared to enjoy your kedgeree with him. Tomorrow it could be your deviled kidneys on his buttered toast.
Will that be all, m'lady?
Thank you, Strabble, it will.
Very good, m'lady.
How long has Strabble been in your service, Lady Eleanor?
Strabble? Oh, for more years than I care to remember. Why?
Well, no particular reason. He seems the very best of service with dignity.
How right you are, Mr. Crefton. Now then, I thought we might all gather in the saloon somewhere around 7:00. Hector assures me he's brought back some tantalizing recipes for cocktails from Vladivostok.
San Francisco. I fancy cocktails would be rather de trop north of the Arctic Circle.
In any event, what shall we do until it's time to dress for dinner, Hector? You're always so clever about inventing amusing games.
If my memory serves me correctly, the last amusing game Hector invented was at 2:00 on a Christmas morning to release quantities of greased piglets into all the bedrooms in the West Wing. Two guests had severe heart attacks. A quantity of bedroom furniture was destroyed. The Bishop of Bodmin forswore hard drink. Maisie Quabarl couldn't look at ham for the rest of her life, and the under-gardener gave in his notice.
Ah, that last seems the only cause for regret. Why did the under-gardener give in his notice?
Because it took him 8 hours to recapture the piglets, and while doing so, he was severely bitten on the thumb by one of them.
Did you attempt to assist him in his task, Munro? You were, after all, the architect of the hullabaloo.
A good architect keeps well away from the building site when his work is in progress.
While I wouldn't go so far as to describe your conduct as contemptible...
No, I'd rather you didn't.
It can at best be defined as thoughtless. Having given in his notice, what happened to the undergardener?
Well, as undergardeners go, Thrapston was a good one, and as undergardeners go, he went.
Where?
Oh, I gave him his passage money to Africa and capital enough to start up in business on his own. He wrote to me recently telling me he has a flourishing ostrich farm in the Gambia. And we took on another undergardener who would otherwise have been unemployed.
What is a Gambia?
I think I shall stroll down to the water gardens again. The very sight of that Venus Anadyomena is enough to renew my appetite for good art.
Yes, I heard about your hatred of that piece.
I should like to destroy it utterly.
Then by all means do so, Mr. Honiton, provided the work of destruction is over by dinner time.
But I understood from Miss Bobo Carew that you valued it beyond life itself.
Oh, dear Bobo was almost correct, save in one particular. My husband it was who insisted on erecting that preposterous statue in the water gardens. During his lifetime, I cherished my husband extravagantly, but on the subject of the Venus Anadyomene, our minds were not at one. So should you, Mr. Honiton, care to undertake that task yourself, I should be eternally grateful to you.
That's uncommon sporting of you, Lady Eleanor.
Sporting indeed. Gentlemen, step this way at once.
What kind of sport did you have in mind?
Oh,
Hector?
You'll hear about it soon enough.
Do you think you were entirely wise to give Hector a free hand? Oh, my dear, it's no use bringing wisdom to bear on anything that Hector does. His way of looking at the world has always been more than a little askance.
Will he ever do anything with his life, do you suppose?
It's a question I've often asked myself, Lady Hampton, and I've found no satisfactory answer.
Isn't it enough that he's himself?
What sort of yardstick is that, Miss Carew? But heavens, would it be enough Strubble just to be Strubble? One has to have butlers, and Strubble has become one, just as Mr. Honiton has become a painter. Although that's quite another matter. Just as you have become a successful actress.
You feel your nephew should address himself to something useful?
Certainly. But he's refused the joint mastership of the hunt, so I struggle on alone. He refuses to collect rare porcelain or 18th century watercolors, and he rarely makes the effort to finish a season in town. He's assiduous about his dress, but less so about paying his tailor. He's a brilliant bridge player, but he seldom has the patience to see a rubber to his end. Even his travels abroad seem to degenerate into, so much philandering with geography.
What would happen if you stopped supporting him?
My dear girl, how could I possibly do that? Such young men are an ornament to society.
What on earth was that?
Hector.
Then he's developed a remarkably powerful voice.
Sounds like a pistol.
It is a pistol. During his travels in the mountains of Carpathia, Hector was urged to buy a pistol against the certain depredations of wolf, bandit, or eagle. But he told me that life was more peaceful in those rocky, goat-strewn wastes than ever it is in Bond Street. So he had no need of the weapon at all. He must be trying it out now with the other gentlemen.
Against the Venus Anadyomene?
I sincerely hope so. I only pray they won't startle the swans, who so respect the quiet life.
I think you must realize that when my party gains power, as it will in the next election, we shall set about abolishing all those seats of privilege and imperialism that presently degrade our social system.
But I believe you have one son at Eton, another in the Indian Civil Service, and a daughter in the Queen's bedchamber.
Mrs. Hope, children should never be restricted by the political persuasions of their father.
You've given a new meaning to the word casuistry, Crepton. If you're typical of your party, it doesn't deserve a single vote.
Dinner is served, milady.
Thank you, Strubble. Ladies and gentlemen, I feel I should warn you of one innovation this evening. Dear Hector, always alert to promote new talent, has recently attended two concerts given by the Nettleship and Treem Light Orchestra. Hector?
Well, having heard their work, I feel convinced that to be condemned to play forever in village halls and to deny so many of our country houses the pleasure of hearing performances of charm and grace in a domestic setting would be brutal indeed.
And so this evening, the Nettleship and Treem Light Orchestra will play for us during the course of dinner. In the anteroom, of course.
Oh, bravo!
Is this another of your stunts, Munro? Oh,
at least it will give us a fresh topic of conversation over the sole meunière.
this meat truly Andalusian lamb, as Hector insists? Or is it local rabbit?
I can forgive Lady Eleanor her absent-mindedness, but not her clear soup.
I've been out of touch with British politics for some time, Lady Hampton. Is it true that Crefton intends sweeping social reforms?
Oh, he's certainly talked of as the man most likely to snatch the country from the arms of feudalism and into the new reality of the 20th century.
But has he the style to carry it through?
He was once heard pointedly to ask for a cup of tea during a trade reception at the Brazilian embassy, which gave him some sort of reputation as a satirist.
The real work of governance can only be carried out in the House of Commons, where, for better or worse, the members represent the wishes of the electorate.
A fraction of the true electorate.
Oh, I'm with you there. I believe in universal suffrage for every sane, free man and woman over 21.
Oh, such nonsense. There'd be rioting in the streets if we allowed every Tom, Dick and Mary to vote. Only the responsible can be given the responsibility of choosing a member of Parliament.
If he's so dissatisfied with England, why don't he pack his bags and head for Patagonia?
Complacency, time-serving, jobbery, patronage, these are the wheels on which the carriage of state makes its backward way. Four schools and two universities fill 90% of the positions of power in government and administration. The wealth of this country is in the hands of less than 3% of its entire population. Yet still, I hear long live Merry England at every social gathering I attend.
Peaceful it is out here.
Anything would be peaceful after the intellectual rowdyism engendered by Crefton over dinner.
But at least he's sincere, which is more than could be said for some people I know.
You must be careful how and where you apply that adjective, Bobo. Genghis Khan and Tamerlane were sincere in their attempts to conquer or destroy the known world. The inquisitors of Spain were sincere in their torturing. Judge Jeffreys was sincere in sentencing helpless men to the gallows. Sincerity without adequate moral imperatives is far more likely to be dangerous than frivolity, which never harmed anyone.
They're always saying clever modern things, but they don't impress me, you know. I think you're a very shallow person who'd rather invent an epigram than a cure for blindness.
But, Bobo, if I had any talent at all, it's for fun, not ophthalmic surgery.
You talk about fun. You never seem very happy to me.
Is happiness a prerequisite of the human condition? The only thing is to avoid boredom at whatever the cost.
But Mr. Crefton, you're of Arthur, Eton, Cambridge, two sound clubs and Parliament. Why cavil at your kind when it's given us a worldwide empire and peace at home?
May I ask you a question? May I ask you all a question?
Well, oh, if you must.
Let's take something as simple as a glass of wine, something we all enjoy. Is it a luxury or a necessity?
If you're starting with a question like that, then clearly you are not one of us.
All right, something simpler still, a loaf of bread.
Must we consider bread when we're drinking brandy?
Now, think of the labor involved to produce that loaf. One man and his horses plow the land. Another sows the seed. Another cuts the wheat. Another threshes it. Another conveys it to the miller who grinds it into flour. A carter delivers the flour to the baker who mixes it with yeast and water and converts it into a loaf. You send someone down to buy that loaf and he brings it into your kitchen where someone else cuts it up and someone else trims and butters it and adds cucumber. Then another serves it for afternoon tea and we eat it.
What else are we supposed to do with it?
What contribution has any of us made to the production of that cucumber sandwich?
I own the land, I pay the labor, they produce the food, I eat it, the circle's complete.
But why do you own the land?
Because I inherited it.
You didn't earn it. It came to you lock, stock and barrel because of the fortunes of birth.
My capital keeps my estate flourishing. My capital usefully employs upward of 200 souls who would go bread less otherwise.
But apart from the manipulation of capital, which you inherited and didn't earn, do you contribute anything practical to the making of that loaf of bread?
Oh, don't be absurd.
did you vote at the last election?
Naturally.
Of the 200 souls working on your estate, how many voted? Well, how many, Sir Randall?
They aren't householders, are they? And the law of the land is what we abide by.
If you were a first-rate shepherd, living with a large family in a tied cottage on 9 shillings a week, denied the vote, having no holiday, knowing no security of tenure, how would you feel about the law of the land?
Struggle.
Are you ill?
You are.
No, perfectly well, Master Hector, thank you.
Nonsense, man, you're ashen.
It's merely the indigestion, sir, plays me up sometimes.
Oh, let's get you to your pantry. You must have a charcoal biscuit and some brandy and water directly.
Thank you, sir. I shall be myself again in a moment.
But trouble, you're far from well.
I'm on duty, ma'am. Not time to be unwell when a man's on duty.
I shall send for the doctor at once.
Not on my account, sir. Please.
Oh, Strubble, don't be so difficult. You know how much we all adore you and rely on you.
Exactly, sir. Reliance. That's what I'm here to represent. If I feel the need of the doctor's attentions, you may be sure I shall send for him. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Oh, Strubble!
Bobo, no. Leave him. If we interfere, we rob him of his dignity.
But he's sick.
Sicker still if he's laid off work. He'd have nothing to live for then.
Why do you care? Why do you care?
Oh, he was kind to me when I was a boy. One can't put down a faithful old dog because he suddenly shows symptoms of advancing age. Now can one?
Ah, and that's that.
You don't mean to say you're packing up now, Crepton, just when you're winning?
Always leave on a winning streak. That way you have something in hand at the end of the evening.
But one hardly gives one's opponents a chance to recoup.
Billiards is a diversion, Omerton. I have more pressing things on my mind.
Oh, yes?
A speech to be prepared, and when better than now, when the house is quiet.
What kind of speech, may a chap ask?
The crucial debate will be on Tuesday afternoon. Your government is poised on a knife edge. I intend to overset it with my speech. Thereafter, expect a successful vote of no confidence and a general election.
You're very confident, aren't you, Crafton?
Too confident by half.
You've all lived much too long in Horseback Hall. Good night, gentlemen.
Good gracious, is that really the time?
Well, if it isn't, then why do you keep such a noisy clock in the room?
Well, I think I'm as scared to bed. It's been a long day.
No longer, surely, than yesterday.
I'm very tired indeed, Lady Eleanor, so I hope you warned Mr. Munro that none of us would take kindly to being disturbed by a rash of greased piglets in the small hours.
The only thing upon which Hector may be relied is never to play the same jape twice.
Lady, may I have a word with you?
Well, what is it, Strubble? You look quite pale.
I should prefer to disclose the reason to you alone, milady.
Merciful heavens, Trouble. Has my nephew been up to something beyond the bounds of even his admittedly lax standards of decency?
I sincerely hope Mr. Munro had nothing whatsoever to do with the matter in hand, your ladyship.
Oh, will you forgive us a moment, please, ladies? There appears to be some minor household crisis that Trouble prefers first to broach in private. Well, Trouble.
I regret to have to inform you that Mr. Crafton has been murdered, milady.
Already?
Already, milady?
One must always be prepared for an attempt to be made on the life of a rabid socialist. Indeed, every sensible impulse applauds such initiative. But that Mr. Crafton should have allowed himself to be murdered at the beginning of my house party shows a wanton lack of consideration towards his hostess. I shall never invite him again.
I doubt if the opportunity will arise, your ladyship.
Have the gentlemen been informed of this regrettable contretemps, Strubble?
No, milady. I judged it best to bring the news directly to you.
Well, there it is. Tiresome, and I do apologize. But these things will happen even in the best regulated of households. And now that you all know, I suppose Strubble had better inform the police.
Yes, milady.
Have we any idea how long it will be before some officer of the law presents himself here?
I should have thought at least an hour, if not more.
Oh, my God. Well, we can't be expected to sit about till then.
Of course not. Nor would such an officer expect it. We must all go to bed directly. We need to be quite refreshed.
for whatever tomorrow may bring.
Yes, there is one observation I'd like to make before we settle down for the night.
We long to hear it, Sir Randall, should it be brief.
Yes. Well, to be murdered, I think we'd all agree, is a pretty rotten thing to happen to a chap.
A chap never quite gets over it, does he?
And I believe that had it happened to any one of us in this room now, the rest of us would be prostrate with grief.
Here, here.
But that fellow Crefton was a rank outsider. He mocked everything we held sacred. He intended to overthrow our government and to destroy the very fabric of the society we represent. So that, although his death may be regarded as a serious inconvenience...
Yes, how does one remove bloodstains from a Persian carpet?
We none of us can pretend to any show of regret.
Oh, quite the reverse, I should have thought. When a professed anarchist meets his maker, the time for rejoicing is nigh.
Yeah. Delighted to note we're of one mind. Now then, and this is where I must tread carefully.
How uncharacteristic, Sir Randall.
Of the seven of us here, six are innocent of this act of retribution. Justice, equity, call it what you will. And one is responsible. Far be it from me to show any hint of criticism. Indeed, I should go so far as to assert that he or she has my unstinting support.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that it's my contention that we should all close ranks. Any suspicions we may harbour, we keep to ourselves. After all, this is hardly a police matter. It's a tribal thing. We must protect our totem, just as the shooter did not half an hour ago. God bless him. Or her.
I think you have characterized our several reactions magnificently, Sir Randall. And I believe a vote of thanks wouldn't come amiss.
Proposed.
Seconded.
Any against? The ayes have it.
Well, Strubble, what news?
The constable at Treem professed himself incapable of dealing with the case of homicide, sir. So he's telegraphing further afield, and we may expect a more senior officer to attend within an hour or two.
Then, safe in that knowledge, I think we may all retire.
Nem com, say I. I'm pooped.
You'd better receive this officer, Strubble.
Yes, lady.
Now, Strubble, I rely on your discernment. If the police officer is just that and no more, show him into the kitchen and give him sandwiches and beer. In the unlikely event that he should prove to be a gentleman, show him into the saloon and regale him with game pâté and a decanter of burgundy. Yes. Breakfast will be at 9. Thereafter, we shall be available for consultation, should any be needed.
Strubble. Master Hector.
This is quite preposterous. You should be in bed, man, not loitering around for the arrival of the police.
It's very kind of you, I'm sure, sir, to demonstrate such a lively interest in my welfare. But when tragedy strikes, every man must stand to his guns.
Oh, don't be absurd, Strubble. Every man and woman, with the exception of yourself, is at present sleeping the peace of the just. Or the unjust.
I serve her ladyship, sir. And her ladyship has given me specific orders to await the arrival of a member of the detective force.
Now, look here. You are not what the costermongers would call a well man. So go to bed. I'll attend to the police.
My place is here, sir, in the pantry. Yours is in the four-poster in the Chilean room.
My dear old Strubble, I'm no longer the homesick little boy creeping back from a disastrous term at prep school. I'm Monroe, the globe-trotter, famed for his savoir-faire from Belpo to the Gold Coast.
But are you familiar, Master Hector, with the dark continent of the human mind? Evil walks abroad, sir. And I must be steadfast to repel it.
Good morning to you, Strubble.
Good morning, your ladyship.
Has the detective arrived?
At 37 minutes past 4, milady.
And how did you dispose of him?
Well, milady, the person in question was neither plain policeman nor full-blown gentleman. So I was greatly exercised in my mind in view of your specific instructions. Finally, I decided to show him to the study and served him a leg of chicken and some hock and seltzer water.
Strabble, your instincts are unerring.
Thank you, milady.
And has he viewed the corpse?
At almost inordinate length, milady.
Well, and now I suppose he'll be wanting to talk to us all.
That was the inference I drew from his many remarks, your ladyship.
His name and rank, was he disposed to reveal them?
Chief Inspector Moncrief, milady. Apparently he's from Scotland Yard and was on leave in this neighborhood.
And what manner of man would he be?
An agate-featured gentleman with no observable graces.
Lady Eleanor, have I your solemn assurance that nobody who was here last night at the time of the murder has since departed?
Seven of us enjoyed our breakfast, coffee, and kedgeree, Chief Inspector. Seven of us are waiting to assist you. The eighth lies dead on the floor of the library and ruining my carpet.
My lady. Here last night, at the time of the murder, has since departed.
Seven of us enjoyed our breakfast, coffee, and kedgeree, Chief Inspector. Seven of us are waiting to assist you. The eighth lies dead on the floor of the library and ruining my carpet.
My lady. May I rehearse the sequence of events that led to the discovery of the body? Afterwards, I should appreciate any comments or amendments that you may care to make.
I'm fully at your disposal for at least 10 minutes.
At 5:20 this morning, I interviewed your butler, Strubble. For a man of his years, he has an active brain.
Mr. Hugo Crefton repaired to the library at about 11 o'clock. Before doing so, he asked if a brandy and soda might be brought to him shortly before midnight.
And was this reasonable enough request discharged?
I reached the library door, sir, at about 10:50. I attempted to open that door, but it was locked.
Locked, sir?
Locked, sir. And from the inside, as I was soon to discover.
Wheels within wheels?
A simple mortise, sir. But strong, secure. I knocked and called, but no reply.
Did you, even at this early stage of the game, suspect foul play?
I assumed that the gentleman had fallen asleep, sir, over his papers.
So what was your decision?
To call the underfootman, sir. Younger and more agile than me by many a year. Young Rasper. He forced a window.
All the windows were closed, even in the heat of midsummer.
I should hardly have allowed the lad to force one otherwise.
Well, well. Get on with it.
Rasper effected entrance into the library. There he discovered the member for West Devizes dead. And weltering in his gore were Rasper's words on the Persian carpet that her ladyship had once brought back with such pride from the jabbering markets of Isfahan.
Damn the jabbering markets, Trouble. What of the key to the library door?
Rasper discovered it in the upper left-hand pocket of the corpse's waistcoat, sir.
And with that key, he admitted you to the scene of the crime.
Such was the manner of my admittance to the library.
And the murder weapon?
Placed on a side desk, sir, beneath a painting of the infant Samuel at prayer.
Such insolence. This was the work of no chance cutpurse, Trouble. Lady Eleanor, I understand from your butler that between 11 o'clock and midnight, the ladies were in the drawing room and the gentlemen in the billiards room.
Apart from Mr. Crefton, who was in the library, preparing until he was cut down some major work of oratory.
Quite so. And until he was cut down, on the table outside the library reposed the loaded pistol owned by your nephew, Mr. Hector Monroe.
I believe that's where it was left, yes.
So that anyone in the household might have had access to the murder weapon.
Should they have felt the need, yes.
And why was this lethal weapon with all six chambers loaded left in such a conspicuous place and with such devastating consequences.
It had been used earlier in the day to shoot to pieces an offensive piece of statuary in the water gardens. The work of destruction not having been completed by dinner, my nephew cleaned and recharged the pistol, doubtless looking to this morning to resume hostilities against the Venus Anna Diomene.
And is that how your nephew generally occupies his weekends, milady?
Well, for all I know, he shatters indifferent works of art in every corner of the globe, Inspector.
But no known record of homicide. Where were you, Mr. Honiton, during the approximate time of the shooting?
Either in the billiards room or to and from the cloakroom.
And that way led past the library?
Certainly. I am not responsible for the architecture of this house.
Hard by the library, on a small mahogany table, lay a pistol with six loaded chambers, loaded by Mr. Monroe after your general passage of arms in the water gardens.
Certainly. There it was, as large as life. Clean, bright, and slightly oiled. I even thought of making a sketch of it during the course of the weekend.
So that had you been so minded, you might have seized that pistol, entered the library, and done Mr. Crafton to death, and then returned to the billiard room and continued your game.
Beyond all question.
What was your opinion of the deceased, sir?
Better dead than alive. The fellow was a menace to society.
Miss Carew, I understand that at the time of the shooting, you were with the other ladies in the drawing room on the first floor.
Well, I was either there or to and from the cloakrooms, which, as you will have discovered, lie on the ground floor and beyond the library.
And your way to the cloakrooms would lie past a certain table
that bore Mr. Monroe's loaded revolver. Quite correct, Chief Inspector.
No. What was your opinion of the deceased?
I detested him. He made me his mistress 18 months ago and showered me with gifts. Then he discarded me a fortnight ago for a female ventriloquist from Baltimore.
Sir Andrew, you were, I believe, in the billiards room when the unfortunate gentleman met his death.
Was I? Or was I en route to or from the cloakrooms, Chief Inspector?
When you heard the fateful news, what was your first thought?
That England was the cleaner for the removal of fanatics of his particular kidney.
Lady Humpton, did you have any reason to wish for the death of Mr. Crafton?
Every reason, Chief Inspector. The man was a satyr. Carnal appetite was abominable. Never did he lose an opportunity to try to make love to me at the opera, the ballet, ever oysters at Kettner's, on the row at the races, even at Henley. His vicious overtures drove me and my husband almost to despair.
He intended to abolish the House of Lords, Chief Inspector, and the majority of my closest friends belong to that order.
His waistcoats compelled my attention but forfeited my respect. Any man who dare dress as Crafton dressed is fitter for the abattoir than the House of Commons.
He was an interloper here, and he reveled in the masquerade. Flying false colours, he insulted everything that I and my friends hold dear.
Your ladyship, ladies and gentlemen, never before have I encountered a case like this one. Never before have seven possible suspects more freely admitted their motives and their opportunities for murder. Every one of you, according to your statements, have reason and means to kill that unhappy man. Yet, only one brain conceived his murder. Only one finger touched that trigger. Only one bullet entered that body.
But we're all aware of this, Mr. Moncrief, so how do you intend to proceed?
You have confronted me with a conspiracy. A conspiracy of seven to protect the guilt of one.
Are you suggesting that we have connived at mass perjury, sir?
It's no suggestion, but an accusation.
Oh, that I should have lived to hear such words uttered in a Christian household.
Christian? Bah!
It's time you left us, Chief Inspector. My guests have undergone quite enough already. The interruption of a pleasant evening, the loss of a promising bridge partner, without having to be subjected to such an insolent slander.
You all know who did it. I know who did it and why. But you're all covering up the traces. This is my last kiss. I was to retire at the end of the month after a lifetime dedicated to the pursuit and capture of criminals. And my superiors looked to see the murderer of Hugo Crefton featuring prominently at the next assizes.
Well, look here, officer. If you know that person's identity and you know that person's motive, why the devil aren't you taking that person into custody at once? Speaking for myself, I've never been easy in my mind about sharing a luncheon table with a rampant killer.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this what's called teaching a grandmother to suck eggs?
That's an interesting new line of conversation, but is it relevant, I wonder, to the matter in hand?
To make good an arrest, I need at least one of the following. Item, a signed confession of guilt. Am I likely to receive that? Item, overwhelming circumstantial evidence. And all the evidence I have points at every member of this household. Item, irrefutable testimony by an unshakable witness or witnesses. Am I likely to receive that here?
Then it looks very much, Inspector, as though the murder of Jealous will remain forever one of those teasing little enigmas that so brighten the annals of British crime. Should do very well as the subject of the introductory chapter of your memoirs, with which you will doubtless be captivating us all in the near future. Put me down for the copy, if you will.
Like you, Chief Inspector, I abhor untidiness. Loose ends are always untidy and sometimes rather unsavory.
Ah, at last. The moment I hoped for and at the first expected.
We all held dear the reputation of Scotland Yard. It's something constantly on our lips when we visit the poor of the parish in order to retrieve items, animal and vegetable, that have disappeared from our estates overnight. We repose full confidence in you, sir.
Here, here.
Why not, therefore, be disposed to favour us with a little of your confidence?
Ma'am, if there are extenuating circumstances, you may be sure the court will bear them in mind.
Very well. Then, in the absence of any evidence that would bring a murderer to book, why not take that one bold step forward and find that Mr. Crefton died by his own hand when the balance of his always febrile mind was disturbed by gigantic pressures of state?
Now, look here, Vanessa, but that's capital.
Brilliant.
And so much more acceptable to all of us than a squalid charge of homicide.
What an adroit mind, Lady Hampton.
Well, Inspector, and there you have it. Never let it be said that anyone leaves Jealous empty-handed.
Suicide, you say, huh?
Look,
suicide? When the revolver was discharged at least 8 feet away from the victim? When the murder weapon was later placed on a side desk 15 feet away from the corpse beneath a painting of the infant Samuel at prayer?
None of us would seek to deny Mr. Crefton in the article of death his reputation for whimsicality.
This is a scandal and a disgrace. Justice can never be served when confronted with such a torrent of facetiousness.
What an impetuous man. Dangerously unbalanced, it seems to me.
Leaping to rash conclusions.
Fellow lacks freedom.
Or style.
Lacks that natural authority that any self-respecting member of the detective force should command.
A pistol shot? Oh, I think so. Don't you?
But what can it mean?
With any luck that our troubles are over. Anyone for croquet?
Whilst I can't absolutely swear hand on heart that it was the most enjoyable weekend I spent in the country, it certainly didn't lack incident. A statue destroyed, an MP murdered, and a senior detective self-slaughtered.
But Aunt Eleanor may be facing more than she bargained for. Invitations to Jarrett's will be at a premium for a season or two.
But wasn't it thoughtful of the Chief Constable to allow us all to go our ways?
No practical alternative proposed itself. After all, Scotland Yard's most experienced detective pronounced himself defeated and proved it conclusively.
So it all turned out for the best, really. Mr. Crefton's been spared all further parliamentary struggle, and Chief Inspector Moncrief has avoided a lonely and doubtless increasingly irritable retirement. Hector, do you really believe he knew who the murderer was?
I'm certain he did. You see, a born detective has an astonishingly retentive memory, and Moncrief's memory served him all too well at the beginning of his investigation.
I fail to see where memory plays its part.
Then cast your mind back, if you will, to Friday night. You and I returned from our stroll in the gardens to find Strubble in the hall and looking far from well.
He was Ashen.
Yet never have I known Strubble's complexion to be other than ruddy. I recognized at once that he was frightened and greatly disturbed. So, capitalizing on the affection that's always existed between us, I gradually inveigled the reason from him.
When I entered her ladyship's service 18 years ago, Master Hector, I was known as Strubble. But prior to that, my name was Dwelf.
Dwelf? Should that mean something to me?
I hope not, sir. But it would have meant something to Mr. Hugo Crefton had I chosen to reveal it.
Why?
Because 20 years ago, Mr. Crefton had a cousin, one Amanda Benricard. She was a desperate and dangerous flirt, sir. And she turned the head of my son, young Groby, when he was then in service with her father as third footman. One weekend, all her hopeful suitors were gathered at a house party, and Miss Benricard paid for her wantonness with her life. Her body was discovered in the gazebo at 4 that Saturday afternoon, and Mr. Crefton it was who persistently identified my son as having left the gazebo at 4:15. A young detective sergeant made it his business to secure a conviction against my son, and he was all too successful, sir. Groby was tried, sentenced, and hanged.
But you knew he was innocent.
A year later, the Duke of Lulworth was mortally injured in a hunting accident. On his deathbed, he confessed to the murder of Amanda Penricard. My son's honor was upheld, but his body lay in quicklime in a prison graveyard.
But it was on Mr. Crefton's evidence that the jury found your son guilty.
He was protecting his own kind, sir. Doesn't it always happen?
Strubble shot Mr. Crefton to avenge his son's wrongful execution.
He did. Judge of his horror, therefore, when the investigating officer proved to be none other than that assiduous sergeant who had once arrested his son, young Groby Dwelf.
Memory? Mr. Moncrief remembered Strubble, and he knew Strubble remembered him.
And Moncrief must also have recollected the conspiracy at that Penricard house party that protected the guilty Duke and allowed the innocent but socially expendable Groby Dwelf to hang.
Oh, dear, yes.
Had he denounced Strubble, we should have denounced him for continued persecution of the innocent, even back to the first generation. The whole ghastly fiasco would have been blazed across the newspapers. His honorable retirement would have been utterly vitiated.
What a pretty kettle of fish. But can Lady Eleanor and Strubble continue to live this lie? Think of the strain it must impose on their relationship.
We're aware that the Chief Constable is seeking advice from the Secretary of State for the Home Office. Sometime or other, a further investigation into Crefton's murder and Moncrief's suicide will have to take place. Justice demands it.
Poor Strubble will face the noose.
Strubble acknowledges that his best years as butler to my aunt's household are behind him. He's decided to retire. Under a new identity, he'll be given passage money to some distant country and sufficient capital to set up in business on his own. He's always confessed to an interest in raising Gloucester cattle. Or was it double Gloucester?
Well, it's clever. Then you always were clever. But it's vicious.
Vicious or accurate? Look here, Bertie. You're a physician, a surgeon. You actually work for a living. You actually try to save people's lives, even if it was at 100 guineas a time.
Oh, now, come on.
You discovered you had gifts. You put those gifts to practical use, so you're exempt from the parody. But the rest, no.
You're going to lose not a few friends.
Oh, friends.
I wonder, would your publishers publish it?
Oh. The dead can't be libeled.
But the living can be asked to resign from their clubs.
In the demotic of the trenches, who the hell cares? Sam Ferriam, Bertie. Oh, God, I feel dreadful.
You look it. But there'll be no more talk of going back to the front. Listen to me, Hector. You have enormous talent and a part to play in the conduct of this war. I'm going to have you discharged as medically unfit, and you can start doing what you should have been doing since the outbreak. Stating our case, pleading our cause, in America, in the neutral countries, and Russia. You know Russia. You know the top boys there. You can help to keep them in the war.
I think I'd like some brandy.
Brandy? Oh. Suppose I might just about. I mean it, Hector. You know the country, you know the people, you know the language. You can ask for a transfer almost immediately, as soon as you're fit to travel. That's the front we need you on, not in Flanders. Here. Get that down, you.
Thank you. I'm a Lance Sergeant, and I earned my stripes. Bertie, I'm good at my job. An efficient platoon sergeant is far more useful than a pack of desiccated writers in St. Petersburg. We fight the Boche. We fight them every day of our lives.
I can respect that. I respect the British NCO as much as any man living. He's the heart of our army. But for heaven's sake, there's only one Saki. We need you. We need your mind, not your bayonet.
I love my men. And I think they love me. If I failed to return, if I broke faith with them, they'd feel, and rightly, bewildered and deserting. They listen to a man with 3 stripes who fights and suffers alongside them. I talk their language now, believe it or not, as you will. Now, I've been in hospital long enough. I hate this inaction. I want to get back to the platoon. Help me to get back.
I'll think about that when you're fit. Meantime, you're a patient here and under army discipline. And here you'll remain until you're officially discharged.
How long is that likely to be?
Judging by Donovan's reports, at least a month.
My men may be dead within a month.
If you were there, could you prevent their deaths?
In some cases, yes. I've done so before.
Now, look. I'm a doctor. You're a writer. I don't presume to tell you how to write. Don't presume to teach me how to cure you. Just obey orders.
Yes, sir. I see. Good night.
Oh, don't be so damn touchy, man.
Thank you for your hospitality, sir. It was greatly appreciated. Good night.
Hey, car!
Good evening, Colonel. We weren't expecting you.
Good evening, Matron. I'm having to spend far too much time at the desk and nowhere near enough in doctoring. How are the patients behaving?
Well, sir, the gas gangrene case is due for the operating theatre at 10. We have 4 other amputees and 1 mustard gas blindness. Huh. The rest are shrapnel or bullet wounds. They're improving. They'll be back to the front in no time.
And Sergeant Monroe, how's his malaria?
Sergeant Monroe, sir. He was discharged earlier today.
Discharged? On whose authority?
Major Donovan, sir. See here, his signature.
Donovan discharged Monroe without first consulting me? Where is Major Donovan, Matron?
I promise you, sir, I did not sign Monroe's discharge.
But your signature's here, man, black on white. Your signature and the time. 150 pip emma, so what are you talking about?
It may look like my signature, sir, but I wasn't responsible for it. At 1:50 Pip Emma, I was inspecting the latrines of Ward E. This is a forgery.
Damn. That's confounded.
Donovan, bring me the details. When he left, how he left, where he was going. I want him brought back here soonest.
For you, but not for me. And the little devil's alley, ting-a-ling-a-ling, to you, but not to me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? Oh, pray thy victory. The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling, for you, but not for me.
See, platoon! Halt! All right, lads, pull out for a smoke.
Welcome back. When they let you out.
Hello there, Spikesman. Yesterday.
You still look sick.
Well, not as sick as if I had to spend another day at the base hospital.
Don't waste any time, do they? Anyway, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
And what's the job this time, then, Sarge?
We're making for Beaumont Hamel. We'll be in front of Pendant Copse and the Quadrilateral. Soon as we can, we push on to join the rest of the company. Then a big advance against Jerry. Right.
Come back just in time for the fun, then, Sarge.
Not a moment too soon.
Nurses, was they back at base?
None that I could recognize as such. But the beds were softer.
What about the grub?
I tasted better out of iron rations. All right, lads. Fags out. Let's be on the move before we freeze our asses off. Sea platoon! Sea platoon! Tension! Present! Arms! Trail! Arms! Platoon will march by the left in column of route. By the left! Quick! March!
The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. And the little devils have a ting-a-ling-a-ling to you, but not for me.
You absconded.
I can't think of a more precise word. Hardly desertion when you return to the front line.
But the CO, this chum of yours, he's going to play merry hell.
Oh, knowing Bertie as I believe I do, he'll accept the forgery and keep his mouth shut. He's paid to send men back into action, not keep them away from it.
But why come back when you didn't have to? You could be in Blighty now with an honourable discharge and your feet up in the club.
I'd rather enjoy a billy of tea with the chaps in this platoon than a magnum of champagne with any man who's left in the cocoa tree. That way of life's over. This is the only reality. Here, on the Western Front. Since I left Burma 20 years ago, this is the first reality I've undergone. Oh, yes, as a foreign correspondent, we have to be there at the center of things. But you're there always and fleetingly as an observer. I was an observer too long. Flanders is where I am, not where I look.
When you were back at base hospital, did you manage to get your story finished?
Horseback Hall. Well, it's all in my head. It'll have to wait until after this next push.
Are you pleased with it?
Perhaps. Little. Just a little sad.
Oh, why is that?
Because it's the last thing I'll ever write as Saki. I shall bury Saki at Beaumont Hamel. When this bleeding war is over, I shall begin again as Hector Monroe. It'd be total insolence to present the survivors of this hell with the kind of nonsense I entertained Mayford and Belgravia with before the war.
It's queer, isn't it? But if I'd lived your kind of life before, it's what I'd want to go back to after.
You won't be there. All the old fat, complacent certitudes have been shaken apart. And Jack and his master advance on a salient. They both fall to the same shell.
You think you're for it, don't you? In the bush tomorrow?
I think nothing of the sort. Spikesman. What about this? After the war, we go to Russia. To Siberia. You are. You've never seen Siberia in the spring, have you?
I've never seen it on Christmas Day, man.
I tell you this. It's the most beautiful place God ever gave to man. London, out of this, was far too tame. But Siberia. It's easy to get a land grant. We can farm. My sister can keep house for us. We discussed this all at great length on my last leave. And I mean it. Just think of all the wildlife at our very door. Within our very doors. A man could live there in less than 100 a year, and I'll make far more than that writing. What do you say?
Not even sure I know where Siberia is.
It's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Look, Spikesman, this isn't a dream. It's a strong probability. You're handy with things, and I'm handy with animals. Always have been. And the game. Meat for the pot. Horses on the hoof for our transport. All the trees in the world for building and fuel. No sound of thunder. Is it on? Will you come in with me?
When this lot's over, yes. But one condition. Before we vanish into this Siberia,
yeah.
I want a full blowout at the Ritz. You hear me? The full blowout. With an orchestra and champagne and caviar and evening wear and a pretty girl on my arm. The whole shebang.
Well, nothing simpler than dinner at the Ritz. All you need is a guinea or two.
Sergeant Munro?
Yes.
Time for the off, Sarge. We're due to march at 2 AC Emma.
Thanks, Corporal. We'll be moving.
Right.
Well then, Spikesman. Here's my hand. The Ritz. And then Siberia.
With a bit of blessing from old Jerry.
It's the bayonet this morning. We'll need no blessing from Jerry when we flush him out with 50,000 bayonets.
You're really looking forward to this push, aren't you? You really want it?
I want it to be over and done with. The sooner the better.
What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. So, back up your troubles in your old kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
Over there, driver. An officer and some troops, if I'm not mistaken.
Very good, sir.
I'd like to speak to the officer in charge of this detail.
Who might I be talking to?
Major Donovan, RAMC, and you?
Lieutenant Anstey, sir. How do you do? Bloody cold, ain't it?
Are the rest of your men farther ahead?
Yep, they've gone to support battalion a couple of hours' time. They'll all be over the top.
How long have you been with them?
3 months. Look here, do you mind showing proof of identification? For all I know in this damn darkness, you could be some damn spy or other.
Are you serious?
It's 4 o'clock in the morning. Can't see your face or your uniform properly. St. Ross, get over here with a torch. Toot sweet.
In the meantime, Lieutenant, do you have a Sergeant Munro on your string?
Munro, yes, yes. Joined us last night at near Bowen Hamel.
From base hospital?
I believe so, yes.
Would you be...
Put a light on the matter. Would you be good enough to shine it on this officer? He's kindly going to show us proof of identity.
Oh, for God's sake, man. Read this.
Oh, it's cold.
Read it.
To whom it may concern, Major R.F. Donovan,
Royal Army Medical Corps, and the bearer of this letter, has my full authority to find 035 Lance Sergeant H.H. Munro, believed to be serving the lines north of Beaumont Hamel, and to bring him back, if necessary, under armed escort, to Base Hospital 4, E.K.P. Flint.
Colonel commanding Base Hospital. Good Lord, what's chap been up to?
He's riddled with malaria. He's ill. And he left base hospital without a discharge.
As keen as mustard, those fellows of mine.
I said he was ill. 2 days more of this weather and he'll be in a coma. We have to get him back.
You better believe he's well-liked. Able NCO, men respect him. You take him now and you have a very downhearted platoon. Loss of morale, bad form just before a push.
Young man, do you know he's Saki?
Saki? I heard tell he's a good disciplinarian, but he's friendly enough. No, never heard him described as Saki.
Just tell me where he is.
Right, well, you follow his track for 5 kilometres. There's a bust-up farmer's by a crossroads. You take a right turn and you'll find relief company outspanned by a wood. There's a wood still left.
You got that, driver.
Sir, Nice up. Expect you'll find him, unless they've already gone over. That's odd. Just slightly odd. Sir Ross.
Sir?
You knew Sir Monroe quite well, don't you?
Quite well, sir, yes.
Would you describe him as a sarky type of individual?
Sarky, sir? Don't think I would. Bit of a toff, yes, and always got his head in a book when he's not in action, but sarky? Not a bit. Quite the joker, usually.
How long to go now?
About half an hour.
Oh. Isn't it ridiculous? I mean, isn't it really ridiculous? Here we are, 50,000 grown men sat shivering in holes in the ground, in the dark and the cold, at 4:30 on a November morning.
Yes.
In half an hour, we'll be sprinting across a couple of dead meadows to kill another 50,000 grown men who are sat shivering in air trenches and wondering why. Are we going to go on like this? Till there isn't a soldier alive?
I've no idea. This war has no precedent.
But there's no reason behind it. Not anymore.
Well, reasons still obtained. We've forgotten what they are. They exist somewhere, I've no doubt. But we shall have to rediscover them later. Now all we have to do is to thump the Hun.
Hector, don't you ever miss England?
Oh, yes, of course I do. Especially at the start of a day like this. Do you?
If it wasn't for you, I think I'd risk a self-inflicted to be back in Blighty by now.
If it weren't for me, what would you be doing there?
Oh, I'd be... like, back in the old job.
Yeah.
Back in the old digs. Down to breakfast with two clerks, two commercials and a typewriter. Landlady comes in with porridge, cream, a plate of fat kippers.
Oh,
those kippers... Plenty of tea, strong as you like. Not much conversation. Then off and out. November, nip in the air, and the stars still shining. Hat, scarf, top coat, gloves, cane. Oh, the old boots, well polished. Down to the station, buy a newspaper, and perhaps a buttonhole. Morning, Mr. Bowles. Hello there, young Alec. Into the compartment, settle down with the latest news. A train rattling away there. Smell of cigars and pipes.
Yes.
Then it's the office and a great hanging up of hats and coats. Then off to the ice stool. 4 hours of logging voyages, insuring colliers. Oh, and Mr. Fothergill, the schooner Apollinaire, reported missing for 8 days in the Straits of Malacca. Calling to Lloyd's. Great discussion. Will they ring the lutein? Then time for a spot of lunch. Down to the chop house for a pint of stout and some lamb cutlets. Then we sit...
Sniper! Heads down! Pipes and cigarettes out.
Sword? I saw the flash.
Then lie where you can't. No answering fire till our bombardment starts.
Go on. Tell me about the rest of your London day.
No. Well, that's the kind of life it was. Not grand. Not a bit like yours. But nice enough. When you look back at it. Just listen to that. Isn't it a throstle?
That's a robin, I think. Yes, it's a robin.
He goes on singing all through this roar.
Just as long as they go on celebrating life, we have a chance.
You've always loved them, haven't you? Birds, animals.
Well, there was nothing else to cling on to in my childhood. Ethel and Charlie and I were brought up by two domineering and frequently sadistic aunts. We seldom met anyone of our kind or our age. But for some reason or other, they didn't mind my keeping animals and birds. I've loved them ever since. They accept the world for what it is and get on with it. They respond to human affection, but where there's none of that, they'll find it among themselves. Have you ever seen a horse in a paddock with a sheep? Perfect chums. They're gregarious. They need association. They'll roam the meadow together with the midges swarming, lazily chew the grass. Just chums. And happy are the chums who don't know that one day the knacker's yard and the butcher will beckon.
Is that why you and I get on so well together? In a field where the butcher's hanging around waiting for us both?
Well, when you're on the edge of hell, you need someone whose hand you could metaphorically hold.
You know, I don't mind the idea of dying, so long as it's quick. If you're alongside me when we reach their guns.
A damn good soldier, Spikesman. And I'm glad to be serving with you.
Blackbird! How greedy, little sod.
Yes.
Oh, how much longer now? My watch is playing up.
It's almost 10 minutes.
Have you got the wind up? You never look as if you have.
Any man who doesn't admit to being terrified of a push like this is a liar or a fool. Yes, I have the wind up. It's clear that some of us aren't going to come through. But I believe you and I will.
What makes us so special?
10,000 acres in Siberia. Out there, waiting for us.
After a blowout at the rim.
Oh, yes, after that, of course. Look, Spikesman, I want to tell you this now, because there mightn't be another opportunity for some time. Horseback Hall is the last of the old me. From now on, I've done with facetiousness. It's made a handsome living, and I took the money and ran. I wrote glittering, heartless stories about people of absolutely no importance or value. People with inherited wealth who lived lives of permanent self-gratification. Yet they were the ones who enjoyed my stories most. And that's the very devil of it. I shall probably be 50 by the time this lot's over. At 50, I've got to change. Everything. The way I live, the way I think, the way I feel. Until this war began, I avoided all the awkwardnesses of life. I've shut my eyes to poverty, to social inequity, to the prevailing notion that property is sacrosanct, whoever holds it, and however they make use of it. My kind and I were us, and the rest of you were them. People to be parodied or ignored. I can't believe how unfeeling I was. Spikesman, I've had 18 months to work and fight alongside them. I am of them.
Sarge?
And they, you, I, are the central core of England. We are of those who decide the issue of this war.
Sergeant Munro!
Over here, soldier.
Sergeant Munro?
Is that Webster?
Yeah. Look, Sarge, some major from base hospitals on the warpath says you've gone absent without discharge from sick bay and he's here to take you back.
What did I tell you?
Where's the Major now?
Over by the OP, talking to Captain Ferguson.
Go back and tell him I'm not here.
You what, Sarge? Well, the Captain knows you're here with the platoon.
Then tell him I've gone ahead on a recce. Or tell him anything, but keep him away from here until the bombardment starts. Then he'll never find me.
I can't do that, Sarge. You'll have me on a visa quick as you like.
There's a couple of officers coming down the track.
Tell me. The taller one's Donovan. Damnation! Why can't he be well alone?
They've stopped.
What the hell are they up to?
The captain's lighting a fag for the other bloke.
Don't they know about snipers?
Keep your head down, Hector.
Put that bloody cigarette out!
From wipers. I long to be where German snipers can't get at me. Damp is my dugout, cold are my feet, waiting for whispers to send me to sleep.
In Who Wrote Horseback Hall by Michael Robson, Hector Munro was played by John Rye. Lady Eleanor Cunningham, Jill Balkan, Chief Inspector Moncrief, Patrick Troughton, Strubble, Robert Edison, and Colonel Flint, John Westbrook. Latimer Honiton, David March, Lady Vanessa Hampton, Rosalind Shanks, Lieutenant Anstey, Peter Aker, Hugo Crefton, M.T., Colin Starkey, Winifred Hope, Anne Jameson, Bobo Carew, Helena Breck, Sir Randall Hampton, Christopher Douglas, Major Donovan, David Sinclair, Spikesman, Simon Hewitt, Hospital Matron, Helen McIntosh, and the Railway Porter, Graham Blockie. The play was directed by David Spencer.